Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It was rough for many students trying to find work this past summer in this economy. Thousands of college kids who needed that money just never got a summer job, so imagine their shock when they found out that tuition at their state university was also going up at some schools close to 40% in a single year. That's a pretty hefty jump by any measure. But it's all the more important when you remember that these are state college tuitions we're talking about. These are the institutions that are supposed to make education affordable for all. Now, some criticize the public universities for emulating private schools, spending too much on extras and not enough on basics. Others fault state legislatures and the federal government for cutting back financial support and leaving students without aid. So, Connection listeners, how is the rising cost of higher education affecting you or your family? What do you think is the right fix? Should schools be required to keep costs low, or should taxpayers be willing to foot the bill to make a college education affordable for all? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today by looking at how this is playing out on the campus at the University of Arizona. Tuition there has jumped from about $2,500 last year to $3,500 this year, and that's an increase of close to 40%, one of the largest increases in the country. Joining us on the line from Tucson is Rachel Wilson. She's a first-year law student at the University of Arizona. Hi, Rachel.
Good morning, Dick.
Thanks for being with me. Now, you've been a student at the University of Arizona for some time now.
Yes, I have, actually. I did my undergraduate degree there and also got my PhD a couple years ago, and then I decided to start law school.
So take me back, Rachel. The year that you first started at the University of Arizona, what were you paying for tuition back then? Do you remember?
Gosh, it was so long ago. That was 1990. And to be honest, I think it was around $1,000 a year, but at the time I had a full scholarship, so I didn't even actually have to pay it.
And have you been able to hold on to that scholarship through the years?
Yes, I've gotten various forms of aid, but the problem is that it's just gotten too much. The tuition is so high now, and the aid I've gotten is all in the form of loans, so I have a substantial amount of debt.
How much is that debt now?
Well, I just took out my first loan this year, and it's for $17,000. The main reason for this is that in addition to the $1,000 increase that the Regents tacked on to the university, the law school also put on a $3,000 tuition increase this year. So I'm looking at $11,000 a year in tuition.
And all your living expenses at the same time.
Exactly.
What's the total debt for all those years? Do you have any idea what you owe now when you add this year's to last year's and all the previous years?
Actually, I've been very lucky in that this is the first year I've had to take out loans. So even though I got all that education before, I was able to fund it through working at the university. So I managed to put myself through all that school.
Rachel, I know that you've been taking a good hard look at that, at the cost of tuition and the responsibility of state universities, that you're part of a small group of students that's actually taken, is it the university to court over this?
Actually, it's the Arizona Board of Regents, who are sort of the controlling body for all state universities in Arizona, and the state legislature.
And what are you saying in that court case?
Basically, we're saying two things. One is that the legislature has fallen behind on its duty to fund higher education. Our state constitution is unusual in that it actually says that state tuition should be as nearly free as possible. So we're charging that the legislature has fallen behind on its duty to make higher education a priority. And we're also charging that the Board of Regents have been misspending our tuition money for the past 20, 25 years.
Misspending in what ways?
Give me
an example.
Sure, sorry. On our campus, for example, we've been going through this major construction boom for the past 20 years. You walk around on our campus and it's covered in construction sites. And most students are saying to themselves, hold on a second here. How is it that my tuition is skyrocketing? I can't get the classes I need. I have to go to school for 5 years to finish my undergraduate degree. And yet we can afford to build all these enormous buildings.
Now, Rachel, if this goes to court and you ever have an opportunity to stand in front of a judge and make the case, and the judge says, well, So prove it to me. I mean, can you point to students you know who have stopped going to the University of Arizona because the tuition got too much for them? I mean, how would you make the case?
Yeah, I have a couple of friends, actually, who had to take a semester off this semester because they simply couldn't afford the tuition. But in addition to that, I would point to some good research that's come out of the Arizona Advocacy Network, which shows that even though our tuition is low when you compare it to other states, for Arizona residents it's quite high, and that we are unable to afford the tuition, thereby our undergraduates graduate with more debt than the students of almost any other state. Arizona is a fairly low-wage state, and so we just can't afford this massive increase in tuition, no matter how low it looks in comparison to other states.
Okay, Rachel, stay with me for a minute, because we've got Chris Hurstam, who's been listening in. He is president of the Arizona Board of Regents. That's the organization that made the decision to raise tuition at the state university campuses. And he's joining us from a studio in Phoenix. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dick. My pleasure to be here.
Now, just so I'm clear, the Arizona Board of Regents is kind of like a board of governors of a corporation. You're the ones who will get together periodically and make these sorts of decisions?
Right. Here in Arizona, there are three universities, Arizona State in the Phoenix area, the University of Arizona in Tucson, and Northern Arizona University in Tempe. There's about 120,000 students that attend those three universities. We in Arizona are very unusual because we have very few private colleges, four-year institutions here. And about 85% of those students that graduate from high school and go on to higher education, they do so right here in Arizona. We are a gubernatorially appointed board that oversees the three universities. We hire and fire presidents, and we annually set tuition.
Are you feeling a little bit like a man on the hot seat as president these days?
Everybody takes their time in the barrel, and this is my year.
Chris, you were a student at the University of Arizona.
I was a student at Arizona State University here in the Phoenix area. I got a master's. I'm 54 years old. I've lived in Arizona 45 years. I'm a product of public education, and I got a master's and a bachelor's at Arizona State.
Do you remember what tuition was when you were at school?
Boy, that was so long ago. That was in 1972, and it was when I graduated, and it was probably around $1,000. But I want to make the point here, Dick, that this tuition increase of 40%, which was a large jump to $3,500 a year, before we made that tuition increase, we were 50th in the country in comparing ourselves to our peer public institutions, 50th. And now after this increase, we are about 38th in the country. And we have a policy that has been blessed by the Attorney General's office and in previous state Supreme Court rulings, that as long as we stay in the lower third of the country, and we still are, as long as we stay in the lower third of the country for our resident undergraduate tuition, we are not violating the Constitution.
That constitutional mandate that says the tuition or the university education should be as nearly free as possible. Those
exactly.
are the words, right?
Exactly. And I want to point out, too, that the $3,500 that we charge resident undergraduates, it costs the university system over $10,000 per student. So each student is still heavily subsidized. And while we increased the tuition 40%, at the same time, we also increased the set-aside for financial aid for lower economic-level students 140%. So we took into account those students that would have the most trouble handling the increase. I'd also like to say that I agree with Rachel on many points. The Constitution we take very seriously here in Arizona that says it should be nearly as free as possible. We don't take that literally, and the courts have not taken that literally, but clearly the state Constitution sends a message to the state capitol, to the legislature, that tuition is to remain as low as possible and that the state has the responsibility for funding our public university system. And the regents agree with the students wholeheartedly.
Okay, now, Chris, but Rachel has both barrels loaded on this one. She says the state legislature has fallen behind in its responsibility in funding public education, but she's also saying that the Board of Regents has been too loose with the cash, building elaborate projects when it should have had a closer eye on the basics, making sure that costs could stay down. Does she have a point there?
No, she has a point, but I totally disagree with that point. If you were to analyze the funding that the university system has gotten from the state capital, from the legislature, for building renewal, for our buildings and our infrastructure and our utilities and our water pipes that are in frankly very poor shape, all of the analysis that has been done shows that we are $200 million in the hole with regards to the quality of our buildings. I'm not just talking about trying to get more computers in classrooms, which we definitely need, and we're trying to use tuition money to do that. I'm talking about basic infrastructure costs. We have an enormous deteriorating campus problem at all three of our universities. So while students may see new facilities being built, they had to be because they're replacing facilities that were in horrible condition, and yet we're still in the hole to the tune of $200 million. So I don't think that's being wasted.
Let me just bounce back to Rachel here because, Rachel, you know this campus well. What do you think of this explanation?
My goodness, this is the first time I've ever heard anyone say that our campus was in poor shape or run down. I can't speak to Arizona State or Northern Arizona University because I haven't attended there, but the University of Arizona is a state-of-the-art institution. I understand that some of our buildings are from the 40s, but they've been very well maintained, particularly because a lot of them are historical relics. So they get extra money for funding to maintain their historical, sort of accuracy.
I'm actually going to leave the two of you to sort that one out when and if it gets to court. But Rachel, I wanted to ask you about something that I read in the Arizona Daily Wildcat saying, it was an editorial saying, we're getting a college degree for less than the price of an economy-sized car. Sure, it jumped 40%, but look at the bottom line. It's still a great deal.
Well, what I would continue to stress, and I don't understand why Chris continues to bring up the fact that our tuition is low in comparison to other states, because it is, but what I want to continue to stress is it doesn't matter. That's not affordable for Arizona residents. We have more debt than almost anyone else who graduates from university. And what I want to say is, yes, it's a good deal because the education here is top-notch. I'm not trying to say it's not,
right. But
it's falling. And it just breaks my heart to see what has happened to this great institution over the years.
Chris, I'm going to give last word on this one to you.
Well, Rachel just said that education is top-notch and it's falling, and yet at the same time she's saying the costs are too high. I mean, you can't have it all both ways.
Fair enough to worry about where it's going, though, no?
But I believe it is going into the responsible areas that will help students in the long run. I think it is a good deal here in Arizona, but the Board of Regents are bound and determined to keep the tuition for resident undergraduates in the lower third of the country. The courts and the Attorney General's office has said that is the legal way to go, and we believe we're meeting the requirements of the state constitution, and we're going to maintain a great public university system here in Arizona.
All right. Chris Hurstam and Rachel Wilson, thanks a lot for being with us at the start of the program here. Chris is president of the Arizona State Board of Regents, and Rachel Wilson is one of four University of Arizona students who are filing a class action suit over the rising cost of tuition. Okay, Connection listeners, is it responsible to take those costs and move them up, just as we're seeing it happen in healthcare, or do the states have a greater responsibility to make sure that education is available to anyone in the state? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a chance to talk about the rocketing cost of tuition at state universities right around the country. And if you look down the list, Northern Arizona University, University of Arizona are right at the top with increases close to 40%. But you don't have to go too far down to find out that in Indiana and Iowa and at Massachusetts, Maryland and Ohio State, the costs are up 15-20%. Right across the board, and in some cases that's pushing the annual tuition cost up close to $8,000 at a state university, and that's a lot of money to pay for a year at university for people who have been told or have been taught to believe that the state university is going to provide them with an education at a cost that they can afford. We're going to pull back the lens a little bit here from Arizona, take a look at the nation. And so we're going to turn to Patrick Callen. He's president of the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education. That's an organization that was created with foundation money to represent the interests of the general public as opposed to the interests of the university or the state or the federal government in matters of higher education. Hi, Patrick.
Morning.
You were listening into the conversation between Rachel and I lost my piece of paper there, and Chris Hurston.
Chris.
And I'm just wondering whether or not what you heard them saying is pretty emblematic of the way this is playing out across the country, that there's it's really hard to pin down who's responsible and who's being responsible.
I think that's right, and I think this is an argument that's going on in many parts of the country. And of course, absent from the conversation was the states, who are in the current environment responsible for much of this because of draconian budget cuts to higher education during this recession. But there's little doubt that double-digit tuition increases at public universities are common. Student financial aid that's provided by the state and federal government for those who can't afford it is not keeping up with the increases in tuition. And in many states like California, these increases have been implemented because the state budget wasn't passed until sometime this summer, 6 weeks before school started. So this is a tough time to be a student. If you want to go to college, you ought to be smart enough to be born in a year where you won't hit college during a recession.
This happened before. This was actually, we saw increases up in the high 30% range in the early 1990s, didn't we?
That's right. I'll tell you what's the same and what's different about this recession. For the past 30 years, the states have basically been using higher education as a cash cow during recessions. That is, in the recession of the 90s, when all the dust had settled and all the numbers were in, higher education got cut worse nationally than any other thing that states support, you know, schools, welfare, roads.
So when you say cash cow, you don't mean they were actually taking money out of them. They were just refusing to give money to them as a way of saving
them. No, they were
them.
Taking money out, and they're taking money out this time. And then by cash cow, I mean then either they or the boards of regents, such as the one Chris belongs to, then turn around and say, well, we'll get the money from the students. Right. And so what happens is, as you pointed out in your introductory remarks, that the students end up getting these huge tuition increases at a time when personal income is not rising, when part-time jobs are hard to find, when unemployment is high, when even members of their parents may be, you know, unemployed. And so these big increases come at the worst possible time. And so my own sense, I don't want to referee the Arizona debate, but my own sense is the question is less whether $3,500 is too much than whether a 40% increase in price in anything in the middle of a recession, at least anything you want to encourage people to do, is responsible.
Okay. Now, In information from your Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, there was one other aspect of this, which is, I think, really important to put on the table, and that is that despite the faltering economy and despite the high unemployment and despite the tuition increases, enrollment is as high as it's ever been. And I looked at that and I thought, well, I got to ask Pat whether or not that isn't just an indication that, yeah, costs are up, but people are managing. It's not a crisis.
Well, they manage in three ways, and many of them do manage. First, the thing in this country that is highly correlated with whether you go to college or whether you don't is your income. So low-income people, even those who become eligible for college, don't go. So we've probably widened that gap a little between middle, even among college-qualified students. And so some people don't go at all. Middle-class families and above understand that because of changes in the economy, the absolute worst thing that can happen to you is not to get some education or training beyond high school at a two-year or four-year college. And so they will do whatever it takes. And the way most of these increases of the last 20 years have been accommodated is the way that Rachel is accommodating hers, through borrowing. And so every graduating class of students, even in the non-recessionary times, owes more money than the class before it. And so we're shifting, without much public discussion of it, loans have always been a legitimate way of partially funding education, but we're shifting to a system in which is basically being paid for by by borrowing as opposed to, you know, that an American tradition, which is that each generation subsidizes most of the education of the succeeding generation. And then there's another group of students who simply, if jobs are available, to avoid the high debt, they work. And they're working probably, you know, we have pretty good research that tells us that when students start working more than about 20 hours a week or so, it starts to affect their academic prospects, and so they don't study, they don't take the classes that they should.
And are they working more, Pat?
Yeah, they are working more. And, of course, we don't know what happened this fall because there aren't so many jobs available. But I was meeting with a bunch of legislators and a group of legislators out in the Midwest, in a Midwestern state a few months ago, where they've raised tuition significantly, cut financial aid, and I told them that two or three years from now, you'll be holding hearings again on why it's taking these kids so long to go to college. And the answer will be because many of them have reduced their credit loads so they can work more, so they can pay the higher costs and avoid as much debt as possible. So it puts students in even those who make it, in a very tough position. And we really need to have some kind of, I think, a national conversation about how much debt we want young people to have. I mean, do we want this to influence their? There was a piece in the New York Times last week on the front page about how so many lawyers now don't want to do the low income things that defending the organizations that defend
the public work and the pro bono
the public
work.
that sort of thing. And so do we want students to make choices of jobs and careers based on how much they owe? We've been trying for 20 years now to get young people to consider professions like teaching that are not highly remunerative, where the country basically needs talented people. And given the salaries in teaching, it seems to me high debt is a way of discouraging that. Will this reach the point? I don't know that it has. Don't think it has yet. Where young families in their late 20s and early 30s, it'll influence their ability to buy cars and houses and all the other things, and maybe even have an adverse effect on the economy. I don't know the answers to those questions, but we're backing into this high debt system without any public conversation of them. The dirty little secret is every time tuition goes up, debt goes up, and that's not discussed by state legislatures or boards of trustees very
often. Okay, we've got a number of people who'd like to get in here. Let's start with Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam's called in. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to comment that I think the conversation is part of a larger conversation, which is about the widening gap between the rich and the poor. And as an example of that, my father went to Indiana University and Yale and got a graduate degree on the GI Bill. And his generation, that was not an uncommon story, that a working class person could, in a sense, get out of the working class category by going to school, and there were programs available that made that very affordable.
What about you, Sam?
That's what I was getting to. By the time I went to school, there were no programs like that. There were some paltry Pell Grants and other grants, and the bottom line is I have a graduate degree in social work, and I can't afford to practice my profession. I'm paying off a $60,000 debt. And as a social worker or a school teacher, no one can afford that kind of debt. But I think the two main points I'd like to make is that, one, this problem can only be addressed on the federal level, and that putting on a state level just increases a kind of shell game of constantly shifting costs. But the real problem is that there's no national program for higher education, unlike, I think, almost every industrialized country, if I'm not mistaken. And the other point is that it's part of an overall program of widening the gap between the wealthy and the not-so-well-off, because as I think everyone would agree, without an education, there's no way to get a good job. And what this is essentially saying is if you don't have the money to go to school, you're not going to go to school.
And yet when we look at Washington today, scratching its head over whether or not the annual deficit is going to be $400 or $800 billion dollars, I mean, what's the likelihood that you know, the case that you're making, Sam, that the feds need to dig in on this is even going to be heard?
With the current administration, I'd say it's the chances of a snowball in hell. I mean,
well, even a subsequent administration is going to live with the debt and the deficit that's being put in place now, isn't it?
I think so much of the debt has to do with the current administration. I mean, we went through, I know we have a short memory in this country, but I think it was only a couple of years ago, we were in great shape. We were having a bounty. They were giving money back. And I'm not an economist, thank God. You know, I don't understand what economists really do. But in my house, if you've got money and things aren't looking terrific down the road, you don't start spending it. You start giving it away. That's what our government has done. So I think I don't agree with you. I think this is largely something that can be addressed, and it just requires the will. I mean, the president's going to get $87 billion at a drop of the hat, and you know that's just the beginning of hundreds of billions of dollars. That's a lot of college tuition.
Okay, Sam, thanks for your call. Let me turn to Pat Callan on this. And I mean, we hear about proposed legislation that would punish the states for jacking the tuition up too high, price caps, that sort of thing. Is Pat right? Is there more that Washington could do to preserve the state university access?
Well, I think in our country, education at all levels is primarily a state responsibility, and it would be a mistake to look to the federal government alone to solve this problem. The federal government has a very important role in it, that it's the major provider of, you know, financial aid that's based on need. The Pell Grant program, which actually isn't paltry, it's gone from $3 or $4 billion in the early 80s to around 12 today, 12 billion. That's a lot of money, and it covers a smaller portion of the tuition at the average four-year college now than it did back when it was smaller. And the reason is because the tuition is going up so much faster than the financial aid. And so I think the states are in the best position to see that that doesn't happen. The Arizona legislature and Board of Regents didn't have to have a 35% increase, and there needs to be a little more, I think, a discipline on that level. And my sense is the federal government has very, very poor mechanisms available to solve the problem. I mean, one of the proposals that's floating around now is cancel the federal financial aid for colleges and universities that exceed the rate of inflation in setting tuition.
Well,
effect, well, then you're punishing the students for the transgressions of colleges and legislatures and Board of Regents, and I don't think there's much of a stomach for doing that in this country. But I do think that it is rightfully being flagged as a national issue, even if the federal government can't usefully solve it. I mean, the colleges and universities of the country don't really want to have a discussion about not just the price, but how the overall cost of college has gone up so quickly, faster than inflation, faster than growth of family income, and accounts faster than almost anything except healthcare and the economy over the past couple decades. And so they have some things to do in terms of controlling their costs and becoming more cost effective. The federal government needs to provide the financial aid. And I think the states have to get off of this habit of feasting on higher education budgets as the budget balancers when we hit a bad economy.
All right. I want to spend a little bit of time later in the program talking about just what the universities themselves can do to control costs. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Durham, North Carolina, and it's Mike joining us. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I should probably start off by saying I'm probably going to express a minority student view here. I started college back in 1991, and I actually went to a private school. I came from a lower middle class family, so much of the financial burden was on me. Then I went to graduate school, got a graduate degree at another private institution, very expensive one here in North Carolina. And then finally,
were you rolling up the debt year to year? Were you managing
to
sort of
the entire time? That's right.
Okay.
And thankfully, there was a little bit of period in between each of these. And then, so finally, I went on to law school. And at law school, I've gone to a public institution. And it's my view that, at least, you know, I think that education is certainly about sacrifice, and I think it's about a lot more than sacrifice, of course. But at its present level, at what I'm paying for tuition, in comparison to what I pay to private schools, I just personally think it's an outright bargain. I don't believe that we are paying for the transgressions of the legislature or the General Assembly or the universities. I feel like they've been far too generous in the past in subsidizing education.
Well, let me ask you something, though, Mike. Is it fair to judge what the state university tuition is as a comparison to what private education or what a private school might charge?
It probably, I mean, certainly there's some distinction that needs to be made. I mean, when you go to a private school, you're obviously making a personal decision to pay extra tuition. I think when you go into a public school, you're probably hoping to pay less tuition. However, I don't necessarily think that the quality of the education is going to be any different. Oftentimes it's better at a state school. I think that, you know, your first guest who was calling in from Arizona was talking about having to pay $12,000 or $11,000 in tuition for a legal education. I personally think that when you look at the value of that degree over the course of 10 years, that is quite reasonable. And if I were a citizen in Arizona, I certainly wouldn't want to have to subsidize, you know, any more than I already would be by, you know, subsidizing what is going to be potentially a lucrative career. And even if she did something like pro bono work or public service, I mean, the loans
right,
are
Mike,
manageable.
Let me stop you there if I can, because I'd like to hear Pat Callan just on the point that you're making, that it's still a good deal.
Well, let me there are two points I'd make. One is, Mike thinks he's paying about the right amount or is willing to pay it. Rachel does not. And the problem is we've sort of lost any sense in the states and in the country about what is fair. Obviously, students should pay something. Obviously, there are personal benefits from this as well as societal benefits. But, what we're doing is handling this on a year to year basis. So what would you tell somebody, who had a 5 year old? What expectations should they have about preparing to go to, about saving for college and how much it's likely to cost? And I think we've always believed that I don't know that anyone believes that individuals shouldn't pay something if they can afford it. But the sacrifice principle has always applied to the adults in the society and to the taxpayers as well as to the students. So the question is, how do we get these things in balance? What do we simply push students to the wall and have them pay and borrow until they absolutely stop going to college? Or do we try to establish some principles about what's fair? How much should this cost and how much of it should be paid by taxpayers and how much by students and how much through loans and how much through work and how much by the family? So we don't discuss those questions much. And in order to resolve this issue, that's the level at which we have to put it, I think, not Mike's preferences versus Rachel's.
All right, let me stop you there. Connection listeners, what is fair? 1-800-423-8255. Pat Callan says things are looking tough now. They're going to get a lot tougher for the children of people who are currently considering a university education. What's ahead? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. This hour, a conversation about the cost of tuition at state colleges right around the country, in some cases up close to 40%, mean rises right across the country somewhere around 15%, and in some cases that's $1,000 or less, but in many cases that's a lot of money for the people who are trying to get a state college education. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour is Pat Callan. He's president of the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education. It's an independent nonprofit think tank established back in 1998 with the interest to speak out for the general public on education matters, just like this one. We're going to go back to the calls to Brewster, Massachusetts. Betsy's with us from there. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a professor at a community college here, and our administration has done a wonderful thing. They have kept student tuition at the same level this year as it was last year. But one of the ways that they have done that is by hiring more and more part-time faculty. 10 or 15 years ago, there were 90 full-time faculty, and 5 years ago, there were 80 full-time faculty, and now there are 68 full-time faculty.
Are you full-time, Betsy?
No, I am not. I am part-time. I have no benefits. I have no retirement. I don't have to serve on committees. I don't have to keep office hours I don't have to advise students so that there's more burden on my full-time colleagues because as attrition takes hold, they have to serve on more committees. We have an increasing student enrollment, and so they have more students to advise. I do meet with students before and after class, but it's not part of my job. It's out of the goodness of my heart.
From your perspective, Betsy, do you think it would have made more sense for the community college to keep its tuition going up 5-10% a year in order to maintain a bigger bank of full-time faculty members?
I don't believe right now that they are allowed to do that. I think there's a hiring freeze. And so it's really hard to know to what extent students suffer from not having full-timers. And I can tell you quite graphically how part-timers suffer from not being full-timers. And I
Well, that would reduce your own commitment to the job. I mean, I hear what you're saying when you develop an interest or an affection for a student and you say, no, I'm going to stick around, I'm going to help that person anyway. But there's no obligation to do that, is there?
No, there certainly isn't.
And not a lot of incentive from an institution that's giving you a check for the hours worked and nothing else.
This is true. I have an office. I'm luckier than many across the country, but I share it with five other people. We all share one computer. We are lucky that we have a computer. And so in some ways, you know, we have a good situation. I do have a place where I can meet with my students, and they can email me, and they take advantage of that. But there is more in the cost column than just the amount of money that somebody is paying.
Betsy, don't go anywhere. I would like to get Pat Callan in and talking about this, because I said we'd go back to the way that public institutions manage their costs. And Pat, I did that with the view that we'd be talking about how they mismanage them, but they're making some difficult choices here.
That's right. And I think it would be hard as an outsider to judge whether this particular community college has the right ratio of full-time and part-time faculty. Part-time faculty have always been an important part of higher education, and especially community colleges. And there's some real benefits to having some people, especially in applied fields, who come in and teach what they actually do for a living.
Right.
On the other hand, we're prone to the same kind of behavior as other employers in abusing the part-timers and not providing benefits or professional working conditions. And that's I don't want to say whether there should be more full-time faculty, but I think the not providing the appropriate professional working conditions and when it's appropriate benefits is not a way. There are other ways we should look for savings. On the other, but I would not want to say that we shouldn't have part-time faculty. I think that's probably more positive than negative.
But I mean, we end up though looking at the contrast of someone in Betsy's situation and some college presidents that are making hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, and these are trade-offs that boards of trustees have to make. And the first thing I think that is to protect the student. And there won't be any faculty there if tuition is raised enough to meet all of the things that faculty want and pay all the high administrative salaries that administrators would like. So clearly, there. But figuring out exactly how much and how many is a different point of view. And I think the fundamental perspective, and this is not an argument for exploiting faculty, but the fundamental perspective ought to be what's good for the students, what allows us to provide the best quality education to students at the most cost-effective way and within some range of quality. And as I say, when you don't often provide the right professional conditions for faculty to meet with students, participate in the curriculum decisions and all of that, then that's probably not a healthy long-run way to go. It may be appropriate in some cases in an emergency.
Betsy, when you think about what the balance ought to be and take your own particular circumstances out of the mix, look at the way it ought to operate, how do you find that balance between getting the right mix of staff, paying the appropriate amount, and, as Pat says, keeping the students' interests at the center here?
Well, the American Association of University Professors has just issued a statement saying that the balance in an entire institution shouldn't be more than 15% adjunct faculty or part-time faculty, and in any specific department, no more than 25%. Now, in my department, we have something like 4 part-timers for every full-timer. And so that's just something to think about.
No, I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Henderson, North Carolina, Kristen's joining us. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. Hi. My question is, are there any studies done on the effect of bureaucracy on tuition costs? I taught for 8 years at a private institution. I'm now teaching at a state school, and the level of bureaucracy, paperwork, reports to be filed, rules and regulations is noticeably greater. It takes away from my time in terms of, you know, teaching and research, and I can imagine there's a cost associated with that as well, as it seems like the legislatures try to micromanage education. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. It's a great question. Patrick.
Well, I think both points are valid. We went through a period in the late 90s when higher education budgets were growing faster in many states than ever in history. And like any other sector, we do tend to pick up administrative layering and things that then have to be looked at. If we do it, if that happens, they need to be looked at, you know, hard at a time like this. And certainly as a prelude to raising tuition, you're probably not going to find the money to balance the budget, but there's just no excuse for that kind of waste. And it's also true that sometimes legislatures, even though they don't like bureaucracy and waste very well, by the kinds of and state budget offices and whatnot, by the kind of unnecessary reporting requirements and bureaucracy that they impose, some of the bureaucracy that they dislike so much themselves. So there's, and then the third point is, I think, the one you mentioned a little earlier, Dick, and that is that there is in some parts of the country an escalation of administrative salaries going on. So some places we have both more people, mm-hmm. and the people starting with the president are higher paid, and we know when these presidential salaries go up dramatically that sort of caps almost everybody else except the medical school dean, the football coach, and the athletic director, who usually make more than the president. So pretty soon everybody else's salaries start to creep up, and we pay as much attention to these matters as we should. I don't think solving them would solve the financial crisis, but they could be a piece of the puzzle.
Let's take a look, if we can, at that student who is currently in grade 6 or 7, and parents are contemplating what's ahead for that young boy or girl, because some of the research that you have done points us to the year 2009. Is that right, Pat, as a year where the U.S. is going to see the largest number of students graduating from high school ever in American history?
That's right. I said I'd tell you earlier, and then I didn't, that I'd mention why this recession is different, okay? This is the first major cutback in public higher education in the modern history of American higher education that's happened at the same time we have more kids graduating from high school every year, building up to this biggest class in history in 2009. And so in the past, it's been periods when enrollment was relatively flat, when we didn't have to both accommodate the students we have now. And in about 20 states, enrollment should be growing dramatically every year. We'll see whether they do as a result of all of the budget actions that are being taken, and that most of this enrollment growth is concentrated in the West and the South, where all the population growth took place, in the last couple decades, and largely heavily among kids whose parents have never been to college. Many of them are Latinos, they're first generation, and these are states where the child poverty rate is very high. So even if we get these kids through the elementary secondary school system and they're ready to go to college, we know they're going to need more financial help than students in the past. And we're sort of preparing for this problem by raising tuition.
Yeah, I see the contrast in that. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. 1-800-423-8255 to Raleigh, North Carolina. And Sam's joining us. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. It seems to me the issue needs to begin with whether college education is a right or a privilege. Certainly, I think if it's a right, the state and federal governments ought to step in and absorb a higher cost of that education. If it's a privilege, it seems that the citizen who wants that college education has to step up and decide what sacrifices they're going to make. The second point is that...
Let me stop you with that one, Sam, because it really does cut to the center of this. How do you see it? Do you see it as a right or a privilege?
I see certainly elementary, junior high, and high school education is a right. To go beyond that, I think it gets more over into the privilege. and our individual choice and what we're willing to sacrifice to have that higher education and the benefits that it will bring to us and to our society.
And do you get the feeling, Sam, that there's been quite a push in this country to include post-secondary education, the state colleges, in under that umbrella of a right rather than a privilege?
I think we're tending to move in that direction, and, you know, it scares me that it becomes that, and then that into itself drives the cost up as more and more people are encouraged to go, who really probably ought to be in the community college network or learning the skills and technical aspects to support themselves.
Sam, thanks a lot for your call. I'll take that straight over to Pat Callan and ask whether or not, Pat, this isn't the public conversation that ought to be taking place, right or privilege.
It certainly is part of it, but I'd say no one believes that it's a right in the way that elementary, secondary is, where the law requires people to go. Everyone, we do a lot of public opinion research on these matters too, and there's no one who doesn't believe students shouldn't pay something for it. But the problem is, it is not just an individual matter. It's a matter of a society that needs more highly educated people than we're currently producing, even though we're now in a downturn. All the long-term projections show that the demands for people with education and training beyond high school, whether it be in the community colleges or the four-year colleges, is going to increase. And the real losers in this country economically in the past quarter century have been people with only high school or less. Their real income, adjusted for inflation, has actually been going down for a couple decades. That's what's pushing people into college, not the notion that it's a right. You do have to pay something yourself, and you have to work. Nobody thinks we have social promotion in very many colleges and universities. So it's not a right in the sense that you should be allowed simply to walk in the door and hang around a few years and get a degree. But it is necessary both for the country and for individuals that people have have this opportunity. College, if you think of it as two-year and four-year academic and technical, is no longer just the most advantageous way of getting to the middle class for most people. It is a necessary condition for a middle-class life.
Which is interesting because it brings it back to a conversation that we've had a lot on this program about jobs and the sort of economic future of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Callan, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Dick. I enjoyed it.
Patrick Callan is president of the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education in San Jose, California. We talked earlier with Chris Hurston, president of the Arizona Board of Regents, Rachel Wilson, a first-year law student at the University of Arizona. Special thanks today to Steve Clark at the NPR station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia, for his assistance. Our program's produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.